Welcome to episode 17 of the Get Ready Podcast. Our mission with this podcast is to motivate you to get prepared for the unexpected. Today's discussion is about gathering resources after society begins to break down. It's a little controversial, so try to keep an open mind as the guys navigate the topic of scavenging during SHTF. Here are your hosts, RB and JD.
Welcome to the Get Ready Podcast. I am RB, joined by the one and only JD.
Hello, everybody. Today, we are talking about scavenging. Would you go on a scavenging run if your family badly needed critical supplies? I know I would, but not everyone thinks scavenging is a good idea. Obviously, some inherent risks in walking around a post-apocalyptic wasteland, zombies around every corner. And sure, sometimes it'll be hard to know if a home is abandoned and free for the taking, or if the owner is a listener of this podcast and is ready for you to start stealing his stuff. But at the end of the day, any SHTF will be filled with risks and moral ambiguity. That's why we're here, to help you make sense of it all. Now, let's take a moment to zero your mind with the Mindset Minute.
The average American is more likely to die from obesity than starvation. You may not be able to imagine yourself stealing food or medicine or fuel today, but in a grid-down situation, the temptation to steal will be stronger than you think. A wise man knows he cannot battle temptation forever. Victory is only won by avoiding temptation altogether. The more prepared you are today, the less tempted you will be to do evil things in your darkest hour.
Before we dive into the main topic, we wanted to say a quick thank you to everyone who purchased our area study workbook from GetReady.life. If you didn't listen to our last episode on area studies yet, go ahead and listen to that after this episode.
Just before RB breaks down exactly what we have available for those of you looking to do an area study workbook, I thought I might just tell you exactly what an area study workbook is. An area study workbook is what is going to take you from being someone who is prepared with some food and water and maybe a gun and some ammunition to someone who's incredibly strategic about everything that surrounds you, what resources you have to bring to bear in the event of a crisis, who you need to contact, where they live. Basically, it is like having an intelligence division working for you, ready to go as SHTF. You cannot do without it. If you are thinking of bugging in or bugging out or making your way home from the city, this is your guide to knowing exactly what lies around you. And if you were to try and do this by yourself, it would take you months and months and months of collecting all this data. We have put it together in a great template in PowerPoint or Keynote for you to download directly from our website, getready.life. So, RB, what do we have covered in our area studies that you can download?
We've created four different workbooks, which actually contain full area study examples customized to your location. So we have four different locations. First is an urban operator, and that's for those who work in a busy city and they need help mapping their get home journey out of that city. The second is the suburban warlord. These are for those who live in the burbs and they need help putting together that plan just in case they get stuck in their house. Number three is the small town hero. These are for folks who live out in the country, but inside the boundaries of a small town, and you're going to need to bring that town together in order to survive. And lastly is the ranch king, setting up a rural retreat that others will bug out to, or perhaps your family will stay there. How do you protect that retreat and understand what's going on around you? You don't need all four. Just pick the one that's most applicable to your situation. And I don't want to spoil the announcement, but we've got a brand new product in addition to these area studies on GetReady.life. We're going to save that for a little bit later on the show. But for now, let's jump into the topic of scavenging.
Scavenging, the act of searching for and collecting anything usable from discarded waste.
There is a lot to cover here, but I think we should start off by addressing the moral question. Is scavenging stealing, and is it wrong?
I will weigh in on that one. Anytime you've got this discussion, is XYZ morally wrong? The answer almost always comes down to, It depends. It depends on how you define what the action is, but maybe more importantly, it depends on your moral code. So when I say moral code, what I really mean is a list of actions that you've identified as either right or wrong. Take murder, for example. I go to my list and I see, thou shalt not murder. Okay, murder's wrong. Got it. The problem comes when you've got two people discussing a particular action and they've got different moral codes. What's moral and good to one is immoral and evil to another. That's why with a prepping team, you've got to have similar worldviews in order for it to work.
Right, right. This is why America is so divided. I mean, pick your issue, abortion, homosexuality, are boys actually boys? How many times should I be allowed to vote? One side sees these things as morally wrong and the other thinks that they are perfectly acceptable. They've got two very different moral codes.
Exactly. If you follow Judeo-Christian values, for example, then your moral code likely comes from the Torah or the Bible. You've got a list of commandments that come from God, and if an action falls within those laws, then it's fine. It's moral. And if you violate one of those laws, then it's immoral. Super easy. Now, if you're an atheist, your moral code does not come from God. So you've got to look elsewhere. You might look to natural law or some sort of hedonistic calculation to determine if something is right or wrong. And there are tons of different ethical systems. Like, actually, I don't think many people know this, but the Spartans would actually whip their children if they were caught stealing food. Not because stealing was wrong, actually the exact opposite. Stealing food was considered a survival skill. So the kids would only get whipped as a punishment for when they're caught because they wanted their kids to be a good thief. So was it wrong to steal food? If you're a Spartan and you're raising your kids up according to the Spartan moral code, no, stealing food was good.
That Spartan story makes me think about tribes. As the Spartan kids grow older, you obviously wouldn't want your adults stealing from each other within the tribe. That would be bad for society, but you would be okay with them stealing from other tribes because you don't really care about what happens to the other tribes.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, each tribe is going to have their own set of laws. And a lot of those laws are about reducing conflict and crime within the tribe. So if you see a goat walking down the road, if you know that goat belongs to someone in another tribe, you just keep that goat. If you know that goat belongs to a tribe mate, then you have to return that. That's the law of the tribes. So these tribal laws, they're meant to protect only those that are within the tribe. And that's why when you marry into a family, they call you an in-law because you're now protected by that tribe's laws. But if you're outside the tribe, then you're an outlaw because you have no protection or safety from those tribe laws. They can take your stuff, they can kidnap, they can enslave your people, they can kill you. In a tribal system, action is not universally right or wrong. It's all relative to who is involved with that particular action.
It's actually really interesting because in our area study show, we talked about the importance of knowing your area's demographics. Don't want to be a minority when it comes to race or politics or economic status, because the majority are going to tribe up and wipe you out.
Yeah, exactly. Tribal law is natural for humans. It's how we naturally tend to act. Even in the Torah, you've got this commandment of love thy neighbor, and it is built around tribal systems. So when you were alive in that time and you heard that commandment, love thy neighbor, you would assume that it's talking about your tribe mate. I think what threw a wrench in a lot of people's thinking is when Jesus was asked about who is your neighbor, he responded with the story of the Good Samaritan. Jesus explained that the neighbor was not just those in your tribe. It extended beyond your tribe, which was completely radical at the time because it implied that the moral code was universal, meaning an action is right or wrong based on the action itself, not based on who was on the receiving end of that action. So it's a very different model than, say, the Spartans, who believe that survival is all that mattered and stealing is good so long as you didn't steal from your own tribe mate.
I think there's also the issue of context. moral questions that you can answer with a clear head and a full belly today become a lot more murky when you're under duress and stress and pressure and the world has fallen apart and you have people depending on you for the basics. But so far, from what I have from this discussion, are two takeaways. One, you have to tribe up with people who have the same moral code. Otherwise, you'll have a lot of moral dilemmas that's going to cause serious group conflict. And two, you've got to study the people around you and understand what moral code they follow. If you live in Dearborn, Michigan, that area will be following Sharia law in SHTF. And if you're not Muslim or a goat, and you don't want to follow Sharia law, that's too bad. You're an infidel. And infidels have no protection under Sharia law. And this is why area studies are so important.
Yeah. Yeah. And a third thing people need to think about, as starvation begins to really set in, your brain actually functions very differently because it's not getting the nutrients from the food that it needs to work properly. So making decisions is going to be harder. Your brain is going to be very foggy. Your emotions are going to be dulled. You'll get desensitized to violence. What seemed wrong a couple weeks ago is now the new normal. I think in short, your internal moral compass goes haywire and you stop really caring about the morality of the situation and you really stop caring about people altogether. I have a relative. When he was young in Italy, he would go out with his brothers and they lived in a little island and they would row around on their boat and pick up all the fish traps of the fishermen and they would steal a few fish from each of those traps and they would bring those fish back to their family to eat. And they never considered it wrong. Like they knew it was stealing, but their mom would be happy because that was food for the family for the day. It was just a way of life. They didn't feel guilty about it. There's no conscience about it. It was just like, oh, that's what we do to survive. And I think that's what happens in a desperate situation is you start to be like, well, it's actually not really bad. The pain in my stomach is overriding everything else. And if you don't believe this happens, read Jonathan Holliman's book, Survival Theory 2, where he spends a lot of time going over historical example after example of this thing happening and people doing terrible acts that they would never do when fed and thinking properly.
So now that we've got all of that context on why the morality of scavenging is debated, let's explore what scavenging is and how it differs from stealing and looting.
Yeah. Okay. So what is your definition, JD, of stealing?
Stealing is taking another person's property without permission.
Yeah. And how about looting?
Looting or robbery essentially is stealing, but stealing is done without the property owner knowing you took something from them. Looting or robbery, on the other hand, is taking goods through brute force. Maybe it's a war, maybe it's a riot, maybe it's a natural disaster. It's overpowering whoever is the owner or in possession of that item and appropriating it for yourself.
Great, that works. And what is scavenging? What's a good definition of scavenging?
As Jeffrey's mentioned earlier, is acquiring items that have been discarded. So where there is no owner or the owner doesn't want it anymore. So if you're struggling with whether something is looting or scavenging, just ask yourself, is there an owner? And if so, does that owner want the property? And if that's the case, you're stealing.
And what if you don't know if there's an owner or not of the property?
That's where things get a little gray. And you've got to make an educated guess. And I guess the context of what it is you're looking to acquire, the urgency and any other kind of background you want to fill in is going to determine whether you have clarity on whether this item is ripe for scavenging or if by taking it, you would be stealing.
It's definitely tough, but at least we've got some definitions on the board. Let's do a test. I'm going to come up with some scenarios and you tell me if it's scavenging or looting. And for the purpose of this game, whenever I say looting, I'm going to refer to any type of theft, whether it's stealing or robbery or looting. Any of it, I'll just group under the name of looting. All right, so here's scenario one.
The grid has been down for a month, and 2 weeks ago, you saw your neighbors pack up both of their cars in the middle of the night and drive off. You decide to head over to their house and check it out, but the doors are locked. Their detached garage is unlocked, though. You help yourself to a few of the yard tools, shovels, axes, saws, etc. Are you scavenging or looting?
You are scavenging, in my humble opinion. Grid has been down for a month. Your neighbor's been gone for 2 weeks. they have, in my view, given up control of their house and of the items inside of it. And that is my final answer.
Yeah, I agree. It seems like a clear-cut scavenging. 2 weeks is a pretty long time for someone to leave their house if the grid's down. So I think at that point, their house is pretty much fair game. Okay, scenario two.
The grid has been down for 6 weeks, and 4 weeks have gone by since your neighbors left. You break the windows in the back of the house to gain access. Everything in the refrigerator has gone bad, but there is a case of water in the basement and a pantry full of spices, cooking oil, and baking goods that you take back to your house. Are you scavenging or looting?
Same as the previous one. Grid's now been down for 6 weeks. 4 weeks have gone by since your neighbors have left. They are most likely not coming back. And someone should make use of the items that they left behind, either because they couldn't fit them in their cars, or because they forgot them, or because they just didn't care. But doesn't matter. This is scavenging. What do you think?
I agree. I think it's pretty clear cut. Even though it's forced entry, I still think the owners have abandoned their place and discarded all that's left. And I think there's an out. If the owners do come back, you can return what you took from them and pay them back if you feel like that's the moral thing to do. So it's not the end of the world. I think there's a way where you can make things right if it turns out that you accidentally stole from them, even though you thought that you were scavenging. Here's scenario three.
The grid has been down for 3 days, and your local grocery store is tossing out all of the frozen food in their refrigerators into a large dumpster out back. You see a few people walking around in the dumpster, pulling out perfectly fine deli meats, bottled juices, cheeses, and even still frozen steaks. You pull your truck next to the dumpster and start to load up. The manager comes out and yells at you guys to get out because they don't want the liability. You hop into your truck and drive home. Are you scavenging or looting?
Totally scavenging. They've given up control of the items by throwing them into the dumpster. Now they belong to no one, and I am helping myself. What about you?
This is a real life example. I actually did this. No lie. I got a call from a friend once after a storm knocked out the power in town for a couple days. And he's like, hey, this grocery store is just throwing out all of this food. Just swing by with your truck. So I did. And he was out there in the dumpster just loading up his truck with pizzas and cakes and eggs and juices. So I hopped in there and I just started loading my truck, and the manager came out and started yelling at us. Now, I actually think it is closer to stealing, because when I look at the facts here, it's on their property. They own it, and the manager did not want us in there taking the goods. So I think legally, the store had a case for if the cops showed up. You could argue that, hey, they're stealing our property. It's trespassing. There is liability. It's not quite scavenging in my mind. That said, because the items are being discarded and they're going to be destroyed in the garbage dump, I think most people would probably be like, yeah, just you could take it. That's fine. Just get out of there, because I don't want to get sued if you get cut on some glass or something. That was the real concern from the manager. I think in a real SHTF situation, none of that would really matter. I think it would be considered more scavenging because the property owners are not really concerned about the property at that point. It's SHTF. The place is going to get vandalized. You in the dumpster won't really matter. But I think in that particular scenario, where it's just 3 days into it and the manager doesn't want you there, I think it would be closer to stealing.
No, I still think it's scavenging. I think they're giving up control of those items. I hear what you're saying is it's their property.
Yeah, I mean, the dumpster is still theirs.
The dumpster is theirs.
Yeah, they. I don't know if they own the dumpster or the garbage company owns the dumpster or if they've rented from them. I don't know. But it's clearly on their property line. I don't own the dumpster. I don't own the contents of the dumpster. I didn't pay for it. I'm taking it. They don't want me to.
Okay, but let's without really going into the legal side of this. Just plain English. I have something I don't want anymore.
Yeah.
I am signaling to everyone that I don't want it by throwing it out. If it stays, if it's allowed to take it, not take that item. It's going to spoil and go bad, and no one will be able to benefit. If you no longer want that item, I will take the item. I am taking the item because you no longer want it. It's different than if you were going into the store where clearly my signal is that I want to keep this. It is in my store or in my house. This is something I've thrown out. I'm just saying I can't have it. You can't have it either because this is taking place on my property. To that, I say, tough beans.
Let's say you put your trash out on your curb every Tuesday. And every Tuesday, a bunch of homeless people start digging through your trash. Are you okay with that? Are you fine with them doing that?
My only issue with someone going through my trash is more OPSEC than anything else. Like, I don't, you know.
You think you're taking your credit card statements?
Yeah, well, they're taking identifiers. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it's probably the FBI getting your fingerprint.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's what those guys in my trash are doing. But outside of that, you want to go through my trash, go through my trash.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think I'd feel comfortable with it. I think if they asked me, if they're like, hey, I'm really hungry, do you mind if I just see if there's any food in your dumpster? I'd be like, okay. But what if I said no? Like, for whatever reason, I'm just not comfortable with you around my house, my family, my kids. I don't want you in my dumpster. I don't know if you're gonna get pricked or something and then sue me. What if I said no, I don't want you there, and they did it anyway? Is that still scavenging? Is that still okay?
I don't see that as problematic.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely trespassing. I don't know if it's scavenging or stealing at that point.
Yeah.
Either way, let's move on. Scenario four, right?
It's been 6 months since the grid went down, and your team hasn't had many run-ins at your remote cabin retreat. One day, your LPOP alerts the camp that two men pushing a handcart are walking down the road in front of your retreat. You set up a hasty ambush and search the two men. They are carrying large amounts of gold, silver, firearms, ammo, and meat. The meat turns out to be humans, and in a fit of rage, your group leader executes the men for cannibalism. The dead men's possessions are divided among the group. Are you scavenging or looting?
I'm curious what the listeners think about this situation. Scavenging or looting? Go ahead and tell us on Telegram, t.me/getreadypodcast. We'll take you to our Telegram channel, and we're going to have a conversation on what everyone over there thinks about this scenario. Scenario four, are you scavenging or looting?
That is looting. That is looting because you've killed someone. You could say, maybe you're going to say, no, hang on. It's scavenging. They were executed because they were cannibals, and now you're taking their stuff. You're not executing them so you could take their stuff. Is that how you're thinking about it? I don't know. I think, this is what happens. Just know you so well that I want to say this and then I want to say that. And then I want to, it's kind of a good point.
I'm inside your head.
I know. Rent free. Scavenging or looting? Yeah. I mean, I guess. Like if they had murdered the person and you killed them out of whatever, revenge, and then you know. Yeah, see, so it. You're going to say, well, it depends on the context. I think the context here of killing, of getting so angry that they had human cannibal thing, I don't know. Is that like a thing? Okay. I think, and I recognize this from one of the books.
Yeah, what book?
Is it the EMP, Equipping Modern Patriots, or something like that?
No, good guess. This is from James Wesley Rawls' Patriots.
There is one, Equipping Modern, is it Equipping or?
Yeah, that's Holloman's book. Patriots? Yeah, that's it.
Holloman. Yeah. So I would say in that instance, if your intention was not to kill them for their good, then perhaps you are actually scavenging. Like, if let's just say that those two guys attacked your LPOP and you defended yourself and you killed them in the process, it's clear self-defense, and then you took whatever goods they had in their little cart, you'd say, well, that is a clear case of scavenging. Mm-hmm. The acts are definitely separate. This is more like, I just got so mad I killed this guy, which might morally be wrong, but that's a different discussion. Oh, and by the way, I'm just going to help myself to their possessions. This is like super interesting. Then you could say, well, if the first act is wrong, then is the second act automatically wrong, right? Like if you kill them out of anger, not because you necessarily had like enough cause, not that it is or it isn't, I'm just saying, like in the story, you got the leader gets so angry that he kills them for being cannibal. Mm-hmm. Then if that first act is wrong, then how do you justify the second act?
Yeah.
That second act wouldn't have occurred without the first.
Correct. Yeah, I do think the two are tied together. Like you said, if you kill someone out of self-defense, it's not murder, it's manslaughter, I guess, legally, but it's justified. Then scavenging after that is perfectly fine. That we agree on. When you're killing someone either out of a fit of rage or because you want their stuff, then you take their stuff afterwards, that's clearly looting. But when it's a fit of rage out of a sense of justice because they've done something bad, then it's instant, like, execution. So I think in this scenario, I would say it's probably a justified killing. The possessions are scavenging. And the way Rawls dealt with that moral dilemma is he had the possessions of the people who were killed set aside so that the group themselves didn't benefit. And they used those possessions as charity for others who didn't have much. They needed a firearm to defend themselves. They would give that away. They needed some money to trade for some goods for someone. What do you think about that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess.
I don't know that I would be that charitable. I think practically speaking, no. I would just add it to the group and be like, all right, you know, winners, losers.
Don't do that again. They're not using it now. So.
Okay. Scenario 5.
It's been 3 weeks since the grid went down, and you decide to take a trip into town to see the state of things. The town is a ghost town. You hear a sound of glass breaking as two teens are climbing out of a back window at a local pharmacy, backpacks full. You look through the window and it's completely dark inside. You can see the drug counter's metal shutters have been smashed and bottles of drugs are all over. You investigate to see what's left, and you recognize a few bottles of antibiotics and a few bottles of painkillers. You slide them into your coat pockets and exit back out the window. Are you scavenging or looting?
Scavenging. Yeah. Scavenging. This one's clear cut.
Because it's been 3 weeks since the grid went down?
It's been 3 weeks. There's no one, again, trying to assert any kind of control over it. Here's a question for you. Let's just say it is looting. Let's just say it's day one. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of looters come in and they loot the place. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're not in that initial wave. And there are a few, you see through the window, there are a few bottles of painkillers left. Mm-hmm. Looting or scavenging, do you do it, knowing that you need them?
And day one?
Day one. Let's just say they're not just painkillers. Let's just say it's like oxycodone. Like it's hard to come by painkillers that, you know,
the good stuff
you would absolutely need, like in case of surgery or something like that, in your retreat, and now they're laying there on the floor, and you know it's only a matter of time before some junkie comes and grabs them.
Look, I was the guy who jumped in a dumpster to get some free sheet cake. So you give me oxycodone, and it's likely I'm just going to bonk a few. Now, frankly, day one is a little bit raw for me, unless I was absolutely sure it was SHTF. Like EMP, nuclear attack, something where like we're not recovering from this. Society is broken down and these store owners have no chance of recouping their possessions. It's just a free-for-all. I'd probably do it on day one.
Yeah, me too.
I say I'd do it out of my natural reaction. Would it be morally right? I don't know. I might have to deal with that situation because I don't know for sure what the situation's like, what the owner is like. I might struggle with that and I might feel guilty later, but I think I would do it and then kind of wrestle with the moral implications afterward.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So this is why I was saying, I think the context of the decision is so important. Like murder, you brought up murder earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, murder, you know, taking someone else's life. If it's done with any other motive other than, say, self-defense, it's not morally correct, right? But in the case of self-defense, it's 100% morally correct. All of these scenarios really depend on the context. And even in day one, you could, I think, morally get behind it, even not knowing that this is the end, because you needed it for your retreat. Somebody else was going to grab it. There is a good chance that this is it. It's grid down and it's not coming back up. You could probably even get around it by telling yourself you give it back.
Yeah.
If the lights come back on.
Yeah. So here's a little twist for you. You mentioned murder, right? We talked about if you murder someone and then you scavenge their bodies, that's wrong, right? We agree on that?
Mm-hmm.
What if you're not the one murdering, but you observe a murder happen and the murderer runs off? Do you scavenge the body?
How deep into SHTF are we?
Day 3. Because we said the outcome is linked to the original action.
Yeah, if you didn't commit it, and if you, you know, it can't be like your buddy did it. And you were, both standing there. He smokes a guy and then runs off. And like, oh, all right.
He's dead anyway.
Chicken Charlie didn't stick around to see what he had. Yeah, I mean, you're going to be doing all sorts of stuff like this. You know, whether you witnessed it or didn't witness it, you come across a body that may have items on them. Like, yeah, I think you're totally going through this stuff.
Yeah, I agree.
And by you, I mean me.
You and then me checking to make sure you didn't miss anything.
Exactly.
Okay, again, we're not really trying to figure out if it's morally right or wrong. We need to stay on task. What we're trying to do is figure out if it's looting or scavenging. The morally right or wrong question is going to be answered by your code of ethics. But the scavenging and looting we can help define through scenarios. Hopefully that was helpful for those out there. Okay. What did we learn here? Sometimes it can be really hard to tell if you're scavenging or looting. If you want to be safe, you can simply store up what you need before SHDF happens, and then you won't have to worry about those ethical dilemmas. But of course, you're not able to buy everything you need ahead of time. There's going to be some stuff that we're going to have to barter for, we're going to have to scavenge. But one area you should have well stocked up on is food. And if not, you're going to like this brand new product that we've got on our website, GetReady.life. JD, what is that magical new product?
So last season, we reviewed some freeze-dried food from a really cool company called Freedom Foods. We were so impressed with their freeze-dried chicken fajitas that we asked if we could partner with them to create something specifically for our listeners. And what we came up with are the new Get Ready protein packs, now for sale on GetReady.life. What are protein packs? Well, as you know, our philosophy in food storage is to layer your preps. 1 year worth of calories and grains like wheat, rice, and beans. Plenty of pantry staples like salt, sugar, spices, and oils for cooking. Some MREs for convenience on patrols. And then you have to layer in some freeze-dried food for the really hard-to-store items like protein and milk. So that's exactly what these protein packs are. 5-pound pouches of pre-cooked chicken and beef that'll stay fresh for the next 25 years. All of our protein packs are GMO-free, the beef is grass-fed, and 100% natural. It doesn't get better than this. Now, there are a lot of companies offering meals. What they'll say is, you know, get 1,000 meals with Mountain House or Augustin Farms, and they sell it to you in servings. And then when you look at the servings is like 100 calories, right? And so your bucket of 100 servings of all these different fancy foods comes out to 10,000 calories. 10,000 calories for your is literally one day for your family of five. So we're not doing that. We are talking to you straight. You're going to get 1 pound of freeze-dried food. Once you rehydrate it, it equals 5 pounds of meat. We also have a larger bucket that comes with 5 pounds of freeze-dried food that equates to 25 pounds of rehydrated food. One, we love the product. We've both sampled these and enjoyed these ourselves. And we want you to have this too. Go to our website. Remember, every dollar spent on the website helps support the podcast and get even more episodes in this series out. Add to your preps with a Get Ready protein pack.
One thing I want to add to this is these protein packs are a little bit different than the Mountain House style meals. You're not just going to pour some water into a pouch, do a little shaky shake, and then eat 5 pounds of unseasoned chicken. That's not the plan here. They're meant to be used as ingredients when cooking for a large group. You're going to want to throw a pound of chicken into a big pot of soup. Maybe you want to saute it with some garden vegetables. We're not going to be consuming the same amount of meat that you do today. You're going to be adding a little bit of meat here and there to give some flavor, some texture, and much needed protein to really bland dishes of rice and beans. Your kids are going to refuse to eat rice and beans for a month straight. They're going to get so bored of rice and beans. But having just a little bit of chicken flavoring goes a long way to make those meals much more interesting.
You can pick up the 5-pound protein pouch in either chicken or beef, or if you've got a large group, grab the protein pail, 20 pounds of chicken or beef in a food grade bucket for easy stacking. Prices are going to change over time thanks to rampant inflation.
Joe Biden.
So pick up a protein pack from GetReady.life while we've got them in stock at a price that's going to be a steal in 3 months. Now, let's get back to scavenging.
All right. We've talked about what scavenging is and what it isn't, and we've explored some scavenging scenarios. I think we need to round this out by talking about two important questions. One, when should I start scavenging? And two, what should I be looking for when I'm scavenging? So let's start with the when should I start scavenging. JD, are you going to jump into the fray early on and try to score some good finds, or are you going to try to hide in your bunker until the crazy dies down?
Well, if you're giving me a bunker, of course I'm going to hide out in my new bunker. Hopefully it looks like Zuckerberg's. But seriously, you're going to have to gauge what the situation looks like in your local area. There are two good reasons to scavenge. One, you need to because you're starving. And two, you came across an opportunity where the risk is low and the reward is high. Nobody who is sitting on years worth of food and tons of ammo and gold is going to leave all of that unguarded so that they can go get shot in the back exiting an abandoned Walmart. That doesn't make any sense. So if you've got a good stockpile of the necessities, or you're producing what you need to in order to sustain your group, or maybe you've got a strong barter network, you don't need to be scavenging. The more prepared you are, the more you should be thinking about how to defend your resources versus acquire. So if you do it right, you let the scavengers come to you and you can trade them for what you need without the risk.
Yeah, and that's a good point. You're going to have a lot of people who are scavenging as their livelihood. They're going to need some place to get rid of all of those goods. You're going to have to sell and trade. Maybe that's where you come in. Also, totally agree. Like, I think there's going to be a sweet spot early on where some entrepreneurial bloke could score a huge windfall if they play their cards right. Let me give you an example of what I'm thinking. Let's imagine for a moment that your county installs a large solar farm 10 minutes from where you live. And you should know about this from your area study. Thousands of these solar panels, perfectly working condition, but totally unusable for the county because, let's say, all of their inverters are fried. Do you just let them get picked over by scavengers, or do you snag a dozen or so to expand your group's solar system? What do you think?
Well, this is like another scavenging or looting scenario, but I think the question you're asking here isn't whether taking solar panels from the county in SHDF is wrong, but rather, should you start scavenging early on, even if you don't need to?
Exactly. Like, do you think there's going to be that sweet spot where there's going to be plenty of items left without any owner that people haven't thought about taking yet, that you could go out there and just round up a bunch of amazing scores in a low risk environment where people really don't know what's going on and you're not likely to get injured?
If this is truly a situation where the property owner doesn't want or can't use the items, then I think it's up for grabs. Take the solar panels, for example. If the county can't use them, my tax dollars paid for them. Right? And so they're either going to sit there for the next 100 years and rust, which they probably would have done anyway with the stupid county running it, right? Or they can provide power to my family. So I say that they're mine. I'm just taking them back. And if the situation gets resolved in a few weeks, then I'll tell you what, I'll give them back to you. At least you know they work.
I love it. All right, good. I think it's a great argument for why an area study is important, so that you know where those resource centers are ahead of time. You can plan out scavenging in a way that allows you to stay ahead of the crowds. Now, let's dig into what that means to stay ahead of the crowds, because I think philosophically, when you're planning out your SHTF plan, this is your tactic that's going to allow you to find and maximize that sweet spot. So, open question for you. What sort of things do people panic buy when there's going to be a hurricane or a pandemic on the horizon?
Toilet paper. Because I don't know about you, but the second I hear that there's a pandemic that's just hit and we all have to lock down, the first thing I think is, oh my God, my butt. No. The first things that seem to always fly off the shelves are bottled water, bread, meat, and canned foods, flour, yeast, and salt, toilet paper, gas and propane, batteries and flashlights, bleach, soap and laundry detergent, band-aids, and non-prescription drugs. I think cooking aids as well. Olive oil, seed oils, those also go pretty quickly. And then obviously over-the-counter medication. We're going to call those items emergency items. It's the stuff everyone should have on hand, but hardly anyone does because they're consumable daily use items that people only keep a couple of days worth on hand. And if you ever run out, you're just going to make a quick errand down to the shops to go get them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if everyone's going to be panic buying those items, or maybe looting, depending on what part of the country you live in, those are places you should be avoiding. You don't want to be in a grocery store when everyone is fighting for the last case of bottled water. I think your first stop should be not grocery stores, but places like garden centers, pet stores, pawn shops, firearms dealers, big box stores. Those should be your first stop. And we'll call them phase one items because this is phase one, right? So the items that JD mentioned, your emergency items, you should already have those well stocked. And then you could focus on your phase one items. So what are some of the phase one items? In my mind, I think garden seeds. There's gonna be a ton of garden seeds. Nobody's gonna be thinking about that yet because they're in this short time frame mindset. Every emergency is always a short-term emergency in the sheeple's mind. You need to be thinking long-term because you should recognize the signs. So garden seeds, I would pick up any kind of construction materials, lumber, plywood, 2x4s. If you don't have plywood for all of the windows, at least on the lower floor of your house, I would definitely make sure you've got the thick plywood, like the 3/4 inch or thicker plywood, or double up on the thinner stuff to prevent people from easily breaking your windows. Any sort of hardware, screws, nuts, bolts, nails, you name it, anything you can get your hands on in bulk is gonna be really valuable. And with that, hand tools. If it's a type of SHTF event where you can still use power tools, I would say power tools are great, but also just get the manual hand tools and saws and screwdrivers. And of course, ammo and firearms, that's always gonna be a hot item. Stock up on some extra ammo. Next, I would look at the camping, the fishing, the hunting, the sporting goods stores, especially bows, arrows, crossbows, any reusable type of ammunition or ammunition that you can make yourself would be super valuable. And then while you're in the sporting goods store, I would look at some walkie-talkies. Even if you have walkie-talkies, you can always get more walkie-talkies. Another thing, if you've got a little bit of land, if you've got a garden going, garden hoses, super important for moving water around your yard. Barbed wire, you've heard me say this before, barbed wire is one of the most important items you can have for security. As much barbed wire as you can. Get your truck and trailer, load up on all the barbed wire. That's your very first place to go. After the barbed wire, you're looking at some fencing, the taller the better, and T-posts, the taller the better. As much as you can grab of that stuff. And then I'd be thinking about dog food, especially if you already have dogs. If you don't have dogs, I'd still be getting dog food because other people you know are gonna need it. Also medication, so heartworm, tick repellents, our dogs are gonna need that stuff. Livestock, food, if you're out in the country, if you've got some animals, any sort of med, hay, mineral blocks, antibiotics. Having sheep myself, newborn formula is super important, that colostrum, heat lamps for chicks, all of that equipment. If you don't already have that, I would definitely stock up on that when you're going scavenging at Tractor Supply. If you're at Tractor Supply or a similar store where they sell live chicks, or maybe a pet store where they've got chickens or rabbits, for your breeding program, I would stock up on all the small animals that you can either breed or eat. Okay, so that's my list of phase one items. You should be going here. Once the sheep will clean out the grocery stores, they are all gonna be headed here to the phase one stores that you just left. That means you've gotta move on to phase two stores. You've gotta stay one step ahead of them at every point. So JD, what do the phase two stores look like and what are some items that you'd be focusing on?
So phase two are your long-term consumables. You wanna hit up places like Goodwill, shoe stores, and home goods. You're looking for clothing for the whole family, especially kids, sized up for several years. You're looking for shoes and boots, especially for kids, again, sized up. Winter coats, gloves, socks, and hats. Again, focus on the kids, focus on sizing up. You also want to have bedding and blankets and pillows for unexpected guests and refugees. Handkerchiefs, rags, towels, and then baby clothes, cloth diapers. Even if you don't have babies, these are definitely, you know, good trading items. And then mason jars and lids, obviously, you're going to need. The idea is that all of these things are incredibly hard to make any kind of quality, the kind of quality that we can make today. And all of these things, you know, like a good pair of boots or a good jacket, you're making sure that your kids have the appropriate clothing. All of those are going to be critical in making it through SHTF.
Yeah, 100%. I want to emphasize what you said about rags and towels and handkerchiefs. I don't know about you, but we use a lot of paper towels in our family and napkins. I distinctly remember the last time my daughter got sick. She was blowing her nose multiple times a day. It was just constantly running. And if that's going to get through your whole family, you're going to run through so many tissues and toilet paper. So rather than burn up all of your toilet paper, handkerchiefs and rags, and you're going to have to do a lot of laundry, which means a lot of detergent. And if you don't have rags, go to the Goodwill. Like you said, your phase two items, you're going to be stocking up on clothes. That doesn't mean just clothes you're going to wear. That means clothes you can turn into rags too. Okay, next is phase three. And by the time all of those masses realize that they're going to freeze to death, if they don't layer up on cold weather gear, you're going to be moving on to the next phase, which are parts stores. So phase three is the auto parts stores and tractor parts stores. The things you're looking for here is going to be your motor oil and your filters. So assuming that you've got some small engines like your generator, if you have a tractor, a lawnmower. And believe me, if SHTF lasts a long time and you don't keep your grass mowed, you're gonna get Lyme's disease from all these ticks, and you're gonna have poisonous snakes, and you're gonna have mice and rats. Keeping your grass cut some reasonable length is more important than you think. Your car, if it's a type of emergency where your vehicle still works, having extra car batteries, tires, and tire patch kits in case you get a flat, fix of flats would be important here. Grease and WD-40 and lubricants, very difficult to get if the supply chain is jacked up, but you want to keep all of your items top functional condition. Bicycles and spare tubes, you're going to be riding your bike a lot. Maybe your bug out trip, maybe after your bug out trip, you just want to get from point A to point B. Bicycles, super important, spare tires, patch kits. And then car trailers and bike trailers and anything where you can expand your capacity to haul is going to be a highly sought after. And then quickly following that, phase four, this is not going to be for everyone. So if you're a suburban warlord, you're pretty much done at this stage. You've got everything on your scavenging list that I think you're going to need to protect your neighborhood. But if you are that ranch king, or maybe even a small town hero, then you've got a few larger items you might want to think about. We talked about solar panels and all of the equipment that supports solar systems. That would be a huge score. And shipping containers, empty or full of goods. Shipping containers could be a gold mine. And then if you remember Jericho, the TV show, one of the townsfolks found an abandoned train and transferred all of the goods from the boxcars into the general store and kept that small town going. So think about the train tracks that are nearby and whether there's trains. Maybe you send a drone up looking at the train tracks to see if there's any abandoned trains. Check it out, see what they're carrying. Gasoline and diesel in quantity if your vehicle or tractor runs. So any underground storage tanks, especially at gas stations, they might require special keys and special siphons to remove the gasoline from the underground tanks. Because you got to remember, these gas stations, they might not have power. So they might have just gas sitting underground in a huge tank that no one's been able to get it out. So there's your opportunity for gasoline. If you live in a rural county, check out the fire stations, your ambulances, your first responder, rescue squads. A lot of these places have their own fuel tanks and maintenance garages. And then think of fuel tankers and transportation vehicles. I think it was the book 299 Days, where a big plot point was a tanker truck where the driver didn't want to drive through the cities, so he ended up coming to the main character's retreat area. So they had an entire tanker truck full of fuel that they could trade. So think about those big tanker transportation vehicles. Home heating fuels, also super important. I know out in the country, there are plenty of older homes, churches, office buildings that have these above ground oil tanks sitting right outside their house that heats their home. And the heating fuel that they use is basically off-road diesel. So you could use that for your tractors, for your diesel trucks. You could siphon that out of these above ground tanks. And then here's a big one. Shout out to Shep for this idea, because he really got me started thinking about scavenging when he mentioned all of the houses in the neighborhood that use propane tanks, either above ground or underground, that you can siphon out into the smaller barbecue size tanks. You need to have an adapter and a hose, but you can buy that off of Amazon. Then all you need to do is head over to your neighbor's house, siphon out their propane, head back to your place. So you need to have some sort of way to transport all those small barbecue style tanks. But what a fantastic resource. All of these thousands and thousands of gallons of propane that never spoil, just waiting for someone to come around and siphon it out. Okay, after home heating fuel, you've got your big sheds and outbuildings. So again, out in the country, every corner has someone selling these wood sheds. Maybe you've got a winch and you can winch them onto your trailer, drive them home, and you've got a house, basically for whether it's refugees or family members that unexpectedly show up. You'll need some insulating material, so make sure you grab some insulation from your big box stores. Off-road vehicles is next. Your ATVs, your side-by-sides, even your small tractors. If you can haul them onto your trailer, get them back to your place. Imagine your security using a whole fleet of electric or gas-powered vehicles. How awesome would that be? Next, tractors, farm equipment, military vehicles, military equipment. Now, I don't want to get into like taking from the military. That has its own set of risks. But I can think of probably five different prepper novels where a major plot point was a particular group raided a military armory, and the hardware that they took back to their group was a game changer. So think of that. If it's truly abandoned, maybe there's something of use there. And the last category, just to wrap this up, is critical infrastructure. Oil refineries, pharmacies, hospitals, power plants. Not that you're scavenging from these places directly, but you're actually taking control of the entire facility and holding that if your group is large enough. And this was actually a central theme to the prepper fiction series called Black Autumn, which, fun fact, they are releasing a movie and a new TV series this year called Homestead. Anyway, in the book, the Homesteads group took control of a massive oil refinery nearby. That ended up being a strategic asset because these various military factions needed fuel for their tanks. They kept that refinery safe and functional, and then were able to trade that oil for a massive profit. So I don't expect most of us to have an oil refinery down the road, but hey, if you do, maybe that's your play in the apocalypse. JD, what did we miss?
Well, I'm sure there are a ton of items we didn't get to discuss, but I think everyone listening to this gets the idea of what it is we're saying. There will be several opportunities early on to scavenge items that nobody is thinking about yet. But if you go down that route, you need to have a few things in place. So number one, you need a plan. Where are you going first? What are you getting? And then where are you off to next? Again, this plan is going to be based on your area study. If you haven't listened to the last episode on creating an area study, please start there. Number two, you're going to need people, both to move large items, but also to watch your back. Three, tools. First off, you're going to need a lock picking tool. You're also going to know how to use it, right? So there are courses you can do. There are YouTube videos you can watch, but you need to get proficient in picking locks. There's a pen testing master key set, which will give you access to things like elevators, truck toolboxes, Ford fleet vehicles, RV cargo compartments, and other things.
Pen testing is short for penetration testing, an authorized simulated attack on a facility where the consultant who is hired to test the building's security uses a variety of tools to try and break in without detection. One of those tools is a set of master keys that unlocks common doors, vehicles, and storage units. These master keys can be purchased on Amazon.
And then you have the heavy equipment master keys. These are master keys for things like bobcats, dozers, and tractors. You're going to need a crowbar, or even better, a Halligan tool, which is what firefighters use for forced entry. Sledgehammers. You're going to need backpacks that are large enough to store all of the goods that you're going to be scavenging. Watches. Everyone on your team needs to be able to sync their watches and time going in and out of buildings, especially if you're planning on meeting up at certain times or if you are worried about people that may have passed coming back, that type of thing. Dog treats. Always pack a few Benadryl into a doggy snack and come back in an hour once you've been able to give a ferocious pup a treat in order to subdue him in case you need to make entry where there is a dog. And then for protective gear, you're going to need firearms. If possible, night vision. That'll help you safely move around at night. Body armor, radios and comms, first aid kits, and if you have, you're going to need a medic who's nearby while you're scavenging, but obviously not put them in danger. And then you're going to need gloves and durable clothing. As far as transportation systems go, anything that'll get you to and from the area that you're looking to scavenge in, so trucks, trailers, that type of thing, you're going to need a winch potentially, and chains and ratchet straps to tie heavy things down. And in the event that it's a short distance, you know, you can use things like garden carts. You know, if you imagine that your neighbor has abandoned their house and you know that they have a propane tank in their backyard and you've got a bunch of 20-pound barbecue tanks and a refill adapter, but you're going to want some sort of cart to carry those full tanks home, you know, you need to have a way to move what you've just acquired back to your area of operation.
Quick question. How do you figure out how many Benadryl you're going to give to the dog? Is it by weight? Do you just, as many as you can fit into their little treat? Like, what's your thinking behind the Benadryl?
I don't know. I've never given Benadryl to a dog. And I've got I got quite a big unit at home. He's like, it's like a buck 40.
Really?
Yeah, but he sleeps so much. Like, I don't even think we'd know if the Benadryl was working or not. Because he's so fat and lazy. He just sleeps all the time.
A buck 40?
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah, yeah. He's solid.
Yeah.
Solid. We bought him from the Amish during COVID, and they assured me he was a Labrador.
Okay. And
I'll leave it at that. I mean, his papers say Labrador. He doesn't look entirely Labrador. And I've never come across a Labrador this big.
140 pounds is massive. Yeah. That's a big dog.
Yeah.
How many Benadryl? Maybe you just test this out. This will be a little test. Start with one. No, you're going to start with two. If he's 140 pounds, start with two. See if that affects him. See if you can sneak by him without him waking up.
That sounds like a great test.
Yeah. Realistically, we can just look online on the body weight. How many Benadryls? We don't really need to put an animal at risk. But that'd actually be maybe a good piece of your area study. You're like, okay, this is a parking lot with some important, valuable things. It's got two Rottweilers. They look like they're 120, 150 pounds each, right? How many Benadryls do I need for two 150-pound dogs?
Yeah, and even outside of that, I think when, you know, SHTF, a big problem is roving dogs. There's a great dystopian book called Fever. It's a South African book. It takes place in South Africa. It was written long before COVID, but it's about a coronavirus pandemic, and it impacts the whole world and impacts South Africa. It's really well written. But like, one of the big problems that they have to deal with in the book are just these packs of roving dogs that will get you when you're scavenging. Mm-hmm. So having a puppy plan that you don't have to necessarily shoot them and alert and tell everyone you're in the area is probably a good idea.
You know why things went so badly in Fever and they didn't go so badly in real life?
Yeah.
Because they didn't have Dr. Fauci to save them.
That's true. That is so true.
If they had written Dr. Fauci into that book, it would have been super short. Just would have been straight over. Everything would have been fine. Yeah. 15 days to slow the curve. Is that it?
That's that. If everyone would have just worn a mask.
Yeah, just wear your three masks.
Everyone just did what they were told. None of that would have happened in Fever.
Three masks, we'd be perfectly fine. People are selfish. Okay, now we're going to wrap up here. Let's do the mission, but in case anyone missed any of these important lessons, I'm going to do a quick recap. So first, scavenging and stealing, totally different things. Scavenging, we've determined, is collecting discarded items that the owner doesn't want, and you're not always going to know who the owner is or if they want it. So you've got to make some judgment calls. The second takeaway is you're going to be far safer and far more successful if you're focusing on items that others haven't thought about yet. You can't be wasting your time in grocery stores trying to get your food and toilet paper stored away. Like, that's what the sheeple are doing. You've got to stay one step ahead of the masses at all times. And then the third point to remember is that you need that written plan of attack based on your area study. You need to have the people in place, the tools ready to go, any equipment that you're going to be needing, have it ready, have it maintained. It shouldn't be a casual, let's go into town and check it out, see what's available. You've got to treat it like a true life and death mission. And you've got to do a dry run of that mission so that you know how long each stop's going to take. I'm not suggesting you actually take anything, but I do think you could time how long it's going to take you to drive from point A to point B, walk around the location, just to know what the timing is going to be like. It's always going to take longer than you think, right? So prioritize. We've got dozens of items listed that would be super valuable in SHTF, but you're not going to have time for all of that. You're not going to have your scavenging hunt checklist and you're not going to go through and be like, okay, got this, got this, got this, got this, got all of them. You're really going to have to choose the best path based on your location, what's easiest to access near you. Pick the easiest, safest path that's going to give you the most return for your investment, and focus on the highest priority items first. So make a short list based on our full list, based on where you're at, what's available to you, and then put that plan together to execute. Anything you want to add to that, JD?
No, I think that's really good. I'd like to end off with today's mission, which is put together your scavenging plan. This is more than a checklist of items you'd like to have in SHTF. This is a written plan on where you're going first, what you're looking for, who is coming with you, what equipment you'd need, and how you're transporting it. Then where you're going to go next. This is a great add-on to your area study file that either you're going to spend months building yourself, or you're just going to go to getready.life, download it, you have it, and you can do it in a matter of hours. And as part of it, you should be able to map out what your scavenging plan is. Bonus points for you if you do a dry run and time yourself. And remember, do not do anything illegal. Do not steal. Do not trespass. Definitely do not loot or rob. Do not plan to do anything immoral or evil. This is all so you can prepare, so you don't have to deal with moral dilemmas. In SHTF, scavenge only what you believe is truly discarded and abandoned, and do it safely.
Robert Collier once said, "Success is the sum of small efforts, repeated day in and day out." Preparing for a worst-case scenario doesn't happen overnight. It takes consistency, small steps to move forward every day. Today's small step is to write down a list of items that will be most useful to you in SHTF. This small effort will make it easier for you to act when everyone else is panicking. If you need help with your area study or would like to stock up on some freeze-dried food, check out GetReady.life. In the meantime, feel free to hang out with us for a few more minutes while RB and JD have a post-show discussion.
What do you think of the episode?
It's good. It'd be interesting to get everyone's take on this, because I think there's a lot of sort of philosophy that I don't know how meaningful it is, just because I think the context thing kind of overrides a lot of this, a lot of the moral dilemma. It's like, if my kids are starving, for me, there is no moral dilemma. Like I don't know for how many people with that kind of context, and maybe kids are starving is extreme, but if I, like the pills, the medicine example, I think when you throw the context of there's been a nuclear strike, you're not sure what the government's response is going to be. People have looted. People are like, everyone's going crazy. And you walk past the store and it's like I don't even think that's really a moral dilemma. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know how much morality plays into something like scavenging. I think the looting and robbing morality piece is interesting. And, you know, we can talk about it. I think the context is going to define like the moral sort of piece of this, but that's just personal. It'd be interesting to see how the group responds to this, I guess.
Yeah. What you just explained is a great example of what we talked about. You've got two views. You've got absolute or universal morality, and then you've got relative morality. And what you just described is 100% relative morality. Context, the culture, who's involved defines whether things are moral or not. And that is one viewpoint, but a lot of people are absolute moralists. You've got laws that say you can do this and you can't do this. And there are some qualifications for sure. But for the most part, like if it's stealing, even if the world is ending, right? If it's stealing, it's stealing. I think a lot of people will view that and they'll just blanketly say stealing's wrong. I think in reality, once their kids are starving or they're starving, stealing becomes blurred and that line changes.
Yes.
But I think people are going to say, no matter what, I'm not going to cross this line.
Right.
Like, here's a good example. Viking Preparedness and Bear Independent and many of those YouTuber preppers, they're like, no matter what, I'm not eating pork. That's their line in the sand. They're not eating pork. And I imagine many Orthodox Jews would agree with them.
But so, you know that even in Judaism, if your life is in danger, you can do anything. You can eat pork.
I agree, but that's their line, their group, their tribe. They're saying even if their life's in danger, no matter what, they're not eating pork. They even go more extreme than that. And that's why it's important, I think, to have a group that's like, okay, we should talk about these moral dilemmas. What is your line that absolutely no matter what, you're not willing to cross?
Yeah, no, it's great. It's philosophical, I guess. But even in, you know, Noah, at the end of the flood, gets told he has to repopulate the earth by starting with, I think, his daughter. And he says, no, like I can't do it. And his daughter, she heard it from God too, gets him drunk and sleeps with him for something that's one of the reasons why the world was actually destroyed, right?
I don't think that's how the story goes.
It is.
No.
Let's Google it right now.
Google it up. Here's what I think happened. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and they all had their wives. So why would his daughter-in-law need to sleep with him?
The next day, the older daughter said to the younger, last night I lay with my father. Let's get him to drink wine again tonight, and you go in and lie with him so we can preserve our family line through our father.
And that's Noah?
Yeah.
Where? What's the reference?
Genesis 19:33. That night they got their father to drink wine, and the older daughter went in and slept with him. He was not aware of it when she lay down or when she got up.
Genesis what? 1933.
Yeah.
1933. That's Lot.
It says Genesis 1933.
Yeah. So look at 1930. Lot and his two daughters left Zorah and settled in the mountains.
Lot and his daughter. Oh, that's Lot.
Yeah, bro. Yeah.
No, slow down. Slow down.
In 36. So both of Lot's daughters became pregnant by their father. So here's the context of this story is Lot, which is Abraham's nephew, was given whatever land he chose. He chose the pasture for his flocks because the shepherds were fighting. And so he went to
Sodom. It is Lot. You're right. And they thought the world was over.
Yeah, they thought the world was over because Sodom and Gomorrah got destroyed. The wife turned into a pillar of salt.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it was just those two.
That's right.
Yeah.
What was the point, though? Fine.
What was the point, though, you were trying to make? Oh, you were trying to make it that context matters, correct, that God told the daughters. I don't think that God even told the daughter. I think it was...
No. I think they get punished for it as well.
Yeah, so back to the whole universal piece is there's going to be some people who they're going to take that scenario and they're going to say, okay, incest is wrong no matter what. And then other people are going to say, the world is ending. We're the last three people on Earth. In order for humanity to survive, we have to reproduce. I think you're going to have a lot of moral dilemmas. And some people are going to say that's wrong. Some people are going to say that's right. And then it goes back to your ethical code. And that's why I think this whole philosophy discussion is so important. Because even though this particular case of scavenging is probably not as controversial as others, many of these gray areas that come up in prepping and SHTF, when groups have conversations, there's going to be disagreements about what's morally right or wrong, what they would and wouldn't do and why. And if people understand, oh, you've got a different ethical code, you've got a different definition for what that means, then they can actually move past the whole like, no, you're wrong, it's right to do, or you're wrong. And they can have a discussion that maybe they can even get to an agreement.
Yeah. I mean, let's see. Let's see if everyone else is in the same place.
Did you find the philosophical part of today's discussion useful? Do you think lying and stealing are always wrong? Or do you think the situation's context will always determine the morality? Join the discussion on our Telegram channel over at t.me/getreadypodcast.